where they are is what initial velocity were they given, how much mass do they have. The mass determines how much local gravity they create. And so just by random motion, you're going to get mass concentrations. So once you start getting material starting to gather in one spot, one of the latest theories I've been reading is that we used to think that the black holes in the center of the galaxies were a rare event. I think we're discovering essentially every single galaxy has a black hole. We used to think the black hole was formed in the later stages of the development of that galaxy. They're now going the other way around. It appears as though many galaxies start off as a... I can't think of the name of the acronym, which means a very bright, hard-to-define object. In other words, it's quite possible that when material starts coming together, that one of the first events, significant events, is the formation of a black hole. Let me drop. That black hole is a huge amount of mass in one spot with a lot of local gravity. It's going to attract other stuff. Okay? Of all the other stuff that's going to start being sucked down toward that black hole, the chances of that stuff going straight in, a beeline to the black hole, and dive straight into it, is a rare event. The majority of the stuff is going to miss the target, so to speak, a little bit left or right, high or low. As such, it's going to go in orbit around the black hole. And so there's something about the way gravity fields work, that whenever you've got particles in concentration around a massive object, they form into a disk. The rings of Saturn, the rings of Jupiter are a good example. There's a whole lot of other exoplanets that are being investigated. Let me drop.
Are you suggesting that because of the black hole is spiral?
The black hole is the mass concentration creating a lot of gravity, which is sucking up nearby material, and the majority of the nearby material does not fall straight toward the center. It has an initial velocity. As such, the initial velocity of each of the individual particles being attracted by the black hole are going to go in orbit around the black hole, and they're eventually going to form a disk. Whenever random pieces of material form around a planet or a black hole, they tend to form into a disk.
But the disk, it's like you're trying to say, if there's no black hole, there's no spiral pattern, which I have a problem with.
The spiral pattern is a number of steps downrange. You've got a bunch of material in orbit around the gravity concentration, whether it be a planet or a black hole. The stuff in spiral and around has to follow the laws of central force motion. Whenever I have a satellite around the Earth in low orbit, it must move fast. A low orbit satellite around the Earth moves at something very close to 17,500 miles an hour. A medium orbit moves a hell of a lot slower. A geosynchronous orbit, 6 Earth radii out, a geosynchronous orbit, that material is only moving, I think it's 6,000 miles an hour. The moon is much further out. It's moving at a much lower velocity. So there's a well-formed formula, which means that period squared equals radius cubed. If you know the radius of an object around a mass concentration, the period of that orbit follows that formula. Radius cubed is proportional to period squared. That's a fancy way of saying the stuff in close must move around not only at a higher velocity, but it's also moving a smaller circumference. Therefore, it makes more revolutions per minute, if you know what I mean. It's revolutions per year, revolutions per century. So the stuff in close must rotate more rapidly in angular momentum compared to the stuff further out. Let me drop. Therefore, everybody expects the stuff in close to move faster. Therefore, the spiral arms should wind up real tight and disappear, like overwinding a watch spring, so to speak. The fact that the arms on a galaxy move in a characteristic way where the spiral arms are slanted into spirals, but they don't wind up so fast that they disappear. The only way you can explain that is by dark energy. There's a whole lot of, let's call it dark dust, distributed throughout the galaxy. It's not illuminating. You can't see it. But there's got to be a concentration, a particular concentration of dusty-like material in between all of those stars in order to get that particular velocity profile that you get. The majority of galaxies turn like a wagon wheel. They should be turning with the hub turning much faster than the rim, if you know what I mean. And they don't. You can only get that phenomena. Let me drop. You've got to follow Kepler's laws, and one of those Kepler's laws is eventually becomes that formula I told you, that radius of orbit, radius cubed, is proportional to period squared. And so therefore, that galaxy should wind up real fast, and they don't. So you've got to have a lot of gravity material that you do not see distributed in a particular manner in that galaxy in order to make it rotate like a wagon wheel. And a high percentage of them rotate like a wagon wheel, like a solid object. Very difficult to explain. Over to you, Paul. Wes, in 2XJM, K2RAW.
And WS2N.
I think of it a little bit different than you. It's a barred spiral. Imagine that you have a bar in the middle of the galaxy. Paul, pick up.
I was going to go with the dark matter story as well, but it's a question of what is dark matter, and I don't know, I think it's some kind of gravity disturbances. Maybe it's not really dust or, you know, what we think of as matter. Maybe it's some kind of gravity anomalies that we haven't come across yet. I just wanted to mention that if anybody wanted to see, it's a 9-minute video, and some of the videos that you have, that you come across with the landing of that Falcon 9 booster rocket back at Cape Canaveral are very short and choppy. A good one is it's 9 minutes long. It's a duplicate of what I actually saw live on when I watched it that night. It's a long URL, so I shortened it to, I made a tiny URL out of it, so it's tinyurl.com/ORM7V3J. Phonetically, it's tinyurl.com/Oscar Romeo Mike 7 Victor 3 Juliet. I did want to bring that up to Dick. As far as this, this is where we could use Craig. Craig always describes this type of thing good. He does the astronomy net on Tuesdays, KD2CXK. I don't hear him on frequency. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm giving you a very light runover of this material. I'm far from an expert on this one. Far from an expert on a lot of things. But you're thinking there's some other kind of gravity phenomena that hasn't been investigated or discovered yet, Paul. Of all the experiments that mankind has done throughout all of its history, we think we see a direct relationship between gravity and mass. That famous formula that I think it's a Newtonian formula. The force of gravity is equal to mass 1, mass 2, times the gravity constant divided by radius squared, range squared. So if you know the amount of mass of two objects and you know the distance between them, you can calculate the force of gravitational attraction between them by that Newtonian formula. To my knowledge, of all of the astronomical measurements, all of the Earth-based Earth surface measurements ever been made. To my knowledge, no one has ever found an exception to that formula, with the exception of this crazy velocity distribution of the rotation rate of a galaxy. And the majority of the galaxies show the exact same phenomena. So you're guessing it's something else on large-scale gravity. Let me drop.
Comment.
West recognized. So you, Paul, are saying that there's some other large-scale gravity phenomena that hasn't yet been recognized. And because they don't know, for the time being, they're calling it dark matter. And there's a hell of a lot of dust in the universe. Once, in each galaxy, once the James Webb Space Telescope is put up, which is an infrared sensitive telescope. And the nice thing about infrared, the longer wavelengths, is it can penetrate dust particles, dust clouds. You'll see things that you have never seen before. Behind the curtain of a dust cloud, you're going to start seeing things. And so there's a medium good chance that James Webb is going to help us discover what is dark matter. Into XJN, K2IW, go ahead, Wes.
I'm going to be more prosaic. But it's a good point that I have. What makes rotation of the matter? Inside the galactic disk. You could have a bar, you could have a disk. And then it is not like if the stars themselves stay in the spiral arms and rotate around the center of the galaxy. Well, if they did that, that the arm would wind up in tighter and tighter over 2 million years or so. So which is the stars in the center revolve faster than those that are out. Let me drop. I could see that spirals are actually what I would name density of wave or standing wave. Don't catch me on analogy, it's just analogy, that's it. The best way I would say is you have a traffic jam. Cars travel on the busy road in the city, bunching up in jams over the course of the day, and that happening at certain sections. But the cars move through the jam, and eventually other cars pile up behind them in the jam. So the wave is at a certain location, with the bunches of matter piling up, therefore, for a while, say, then moving on the replaced by other matter space. So the dust and the gas is compressed in the spirals. It could be heated, and it makes a formation of the new stars. So the star formation makes a sort of trailing edge, and the spiral brighter of the places where the density wave is different. So that's what I see. I was trying to find not only why do we have spiral, but what makes the movement of the spiral. And to explain.
Okay, let's go one step at a time. Movement of the spirals. Let's talk about movement of the galaxy. Do you have any trouble accepting the fact that every galaxy is in rotation? That all the material in the galaxy is essentially in orbit around the center of the galaxy, the nucleus of the galaxy. That everything is in motion. If it wasn't in circular motion, the gravitational attraction would just suck everything into the center and it's game over. So, first of all, do you have any trouble accepting the fact that essentially every galaxy must be rotating?
I don't. Only the question is why.
Why are they rotating? They have no choice. If they weren't rotating, what would happen to the individual stars of that galaxy? If by some means I could stop a galaxy from rotating and then let go of it, tell me what would happen.
No. It's what they mean is understanding. The Milky Way is the number of different systems that moves around in one spiral fashion. We're not talking about just one body around the solar system or the solar system by itself, which is also interesting. We're talking about a Milky Way. What makes them move?
Are you talking about the cyclic motion up and down through the disk, or are you talking about individual stars? There's 10 to the 11 stars approximately in each galaxy. Each one of those stars is in rotation around the nucleus at some given rate. So which one of the motions are you questioning? Go ahead.
Well, before I go there, we could have a disk base spiral galaxy, which two-thirds of the galaxy are similar way. Or we could have a barred spiral galaxy with the center bar shape structure that composed of the stars. So we have a certain center that is a base, but then all around the Milky Way you see spiral. So I don't have a problem with the singular planet or star. I'm talking about a concentration of the systems in the spiral wave. What makes them move?
Are you asking why are there individual spirals as opposed to a uniform disk of material? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, that's a good question. That's what you're
asking. C2IS, query.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, assuming that with a totally solid Earth, no liquid parts of it, or totally solid planet, I'm told that, say, if you drilled a hole 50% down towards the core of that planet and stood there, you would experience, a G-force, gravity, that was essentially would be of a planet of the remaining radius from your position to the center of the planet, that essentially all the mass above you and in the spherical shell above you would not count towards or those forces would cancel out when it came to calculating the G-forces that you felt. Let me break for a second. So if we can assume this to be true, and the same effect takes place in the galaxy with all its mass sort of scattered around, why would we then assume that the objects towards the center of that galaxy would revolve around the center of the galaxy so much faster than everything else? Would they not essentially be seeing lower force of attraction due to gravity towards the center of the galaxy? AC2IS.
You bring up a very good point, Paul. If I take it to the logical extreme, if I could drill a hole, if I didn't have high temperature problems and high pressure problems, if I could drill a hole all the way to the center of the Earth, at the center of the Earth I would feel zero gravity. If I go halfway there, I would feel the amount of gravity of a planet of that diameter equal to my radius. Everything above you is in cancellation because of the spherical symmetry above you. Based on the assumption that the density of the material throughout the depth of the planet is constant, there's a little bit of a rub on that one. We've obviously got a higher density of material down at the bottom than we do near the surface, so that has to be modified accordingly. And the same thing happens with, in the case of a galaxy. Let me drop. But now the real question is, what percentage of the mass of a galaxy is the kind of black holes in the center? You have a bunch of supermassive stars and or black holes in the center of a galaxy. If the majority of the mass is in the center, then you have simple central force motion where all of the objects in the disk are now going to follow that radius cubed equals period squared, proportional to period squared, Newtonian formula. If you don't have the majority of the mass in the center, if the mass is reasonably distributed throughout the whole galaxy, somewhat like the material of the Earth in your example, reasonably distributed throughout the whole diameter of the Earth, then you get this decreasing gravity as you get closer to the center. Therefore, the period doesn't have to change as fast. The velocity proportional to exponentially proportional to radius, it doesn't have to change as fast. Therefore, you get a little bit closer to constant rotation of each of the spokes, each of the spiral arms. So there's the real question, as I see it, Bill. Is the majority of the mass of a galaxy uniformly distributed, so to speak? If I take a uniform, let me drop it. If model number one of a galaxy is uniform distribution throughout the disk of the mass, and model number two is central mass concentration, depending on which of those models is dominant, will make a huge difference in the way it rotates. The word I was trying to think of earlier is quasar. As you look at the perimeter of the ultra-deep field picture done by Hubble, you'll discover in the very early universe, which we can now see out at the perimeter, a lot of the things were quasars. What is a quasar? Quasi-stellar object, which is emitting an amount of light equal to a galaxy, but it looks like a star. Is that the beginning of the black holes in the forming of galaxies in the early universe? Interesting question. I don't know. But these quasars are somehow involved with the early formation of galaxies. It looks like you could come up with a conclusion. Let me drop it. That a lot of the things that we look at today that we call galaxy started off as a quasar. A quasar is when a whole lot of material, one guess is that a whole lot of material fell together. It's in the form, in the process of forming a black hole and emitting a tremendous amount of energy. These quasars, in general, are emitting as much energy as a whole darn galaxy. Over to you for any further comments on all of this, Bill. Good question. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, AC2IS here. So, yeah, based on what you've just said, I guess it's believed that masses is very unevenly distributed with all these black holes at the center of the galaxy, which should make the center rotate much more quickly. But then people assume that there's this other dark matter elsewhere, which explains it not rotating so quickly at the center. But I guess the first question that comes to mind is, why would you just not ditch the assumption that the center of the galaxy is full of black holes? I guess I don't know much about this subject. I assume there are other reasons to believe there are black holes at the center of the galaxy. AC2IS, I'll be on the side.
The majority of stars in the universe are binary stars. They're going around, they're pairs and triplets going around each other. Our solar system happens to be a unary star, it's not a binary. The unaries are a little bit more rare. If the majority of the stars are binaries or trinaries, I think we're also going to discover a significant percentage of the black holes are also binaries. And when you get a gamma ray burst, is where, for a few seconds, something in a galaxy puts out an amount of energy of the whole darn galaxy in that one point object, whatever the heck it is. Some people think it's a pair of black holes or a pair of neutron stars coming together. They've been in orbit around each other, and they've suddenly radiated out a lot of gravitational energy. Their orbits decreased. They went faster and faster, closer and closer, and they eventually crash into each other. And a tremendous amount of energy is released in that event. That's a guess as to what is a gamma ray burst. These gamma ray bursts, no matter what you put out there to measure the amount of energy of a gamma ray burst, I think everything we've ever put out there eventually gets saturated. Some event happens that's a hell of a lot more energy than you've ever set up that detector for. And you peg the meter, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So it's fairly low in frequency, but a significant number of events are emitting a tremendous amount of energy. And I am guessing that a lot of the nucleuses of a lot of the galaxies are going to be either supermassive stars and or supermassive black holes and a combination of them in orbit around each other. What little bit we've seen in the center of our galaxy, we have seen some supermassive stars going around each other in highly elliptical orbits. And so when two galaxies crash into each other, so to speak, it's a very different crash than you would think. I mean, if I take two rocks and put them at high velocity and make them crash to each other, you get a whole lot of breakup of material. Let me drop. In the case of a galaxy, the spacing between the stars is huge. I mean, we live in a reasonably dense portion of this galaxy, but the nearest star to us is 4 light years away. That's a long distance. There's a lot of space in between. When two galaxies crash into each other, the majority of the stars of Galaxy A do not hit the majority of stars of Galaxy B. They fold through each other. They sense the gravity. Each galaxy senses the gravity characteristics of the other galaxy. But very little impacts take place when two galaxies fold through each other. However, if the trajectory is such that the nucleus of Galaxy A comes close to the nucleus of Galaxy B, I think there's a high probability that those individual supermassive things in the nucleus of those galaxies end up in orbit around each other. That's one possible guess as to how we see what we see right now dimly through a whole bunch of dust in the center of our galaxy. Let me drop. And when James Webb is put into operation, we're going to get a much better view of what's really going on in the center of our galaxy. The center of our galaxy is an extremely active region. The best explanation for that is that when, why can't I think of his name now, 1932, the guy who invented radio astronomy, so to speak. What was his name?
You talking about Hubble?
No. A engineer of Bell Laboratories in 1932 was asked to find out where the hell is all that noise in our atmosphere coming from. He set up this Sturber curtain antenna, rotatable antenna, and the antenna is a national monument. It is now sitting in the front yard of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. I've been there, put my hands on it, and rotated this thing that's about 25 feet wide and about 10 feet high and about 6 feet deep, this antenna array. He built this thing in New Jersey at Bell Laboratories, rotated it, saw a source of noise, and he recognized the fact that when he makes the measurements from day to day, the direction that he measured where the maximum noise was coming from was slowly shifting. He soon discovered that what he was discovering, the Cygnus X galaxy, the Cygnus X radio source, is the center of our galaxy. So at that time, the noisiest thing he could find, including the sun, the noisiest thing he could find was the center of our galaxy. He made that measurement in 1932. Why can't I think of his name?
Chansky. I doubled with John before. Chansky, I think his name was.
That's the guy, Carl Chansky. Carl Chansky, you could say, invented radio astronomy because he found the first exoplanet source of noise, radio noise. Huge amount of radio noise because it's a long distance away from us. I think if I had to make a guess, it's 30,000 light years away from us is where the center of our galaxy is. And that's the noisiest radio object he could find in 1932. He made the measurement, said it was interesting, published an article on it, and dropped it. And along came Grote Reber, W9GRS, I think it's his call letters, where he built a 33-foot diameter parabolic dish, and he started making a hell of a lot more measurements. And that dish is also at Green Bank, the second radio telescope, so to speak, and a hell of a lot higher sensitivity and a hell of a lot more directivity, running at a lot higher frequencies. Carl Jansky made his measurements at something like 18 megacycles, whereas Grobe Reber made his measurements up to at least 900 megacycles, if not beyond. Let me drop. So there's a lot of activity of some kind. You could say that one of the loudest radio objects in our celestial sky is the center of our galaxy. Whatever is going on there, it's making a lot of radio noise. It's 33,000 light years away, and except for some solar bursts that happened right at World War II, it wasn't until World War II that a radar first measured the noise coming out of the sun. That was roughly 1944, and we thought it was a German jammer. We didn't even know what the hell it was, but it was the sun. But up until that solar burst at the end of World War II, which is one of the peaks of the sunspot cycle, the noisiest thing in the sky, with those kind of, with the equipment at those frequencies at that time, was the center of our galaxy. So there's a lot of action going on there. So we can now question, what is the mass concentration like? Therefore, what should be the proper proper rotation rate of the objects around that nucleus? I didn't think we were going to get into this tonight.
Another question.
I thought we were going to get into...
Why does the moon orbit the Earth? What makes the speed of that rotation or orbit made? What is it, the solar day? 27 days is the one solar day. But what makes that speed at that rate? Intuition.
If it's going to be in orbit around the Earth, the 27 or 28 day orbital period is strictly a function of what is the radius of that orbit.
What did energy to make the moon rotating come from? What makes it rotate?
You're really asking where did the moon... I think you're asking where did the moon come from and how did it get here?
No, that I know. Collision of two, like, Earth planets, and part of it was ripped off and placed there. No. The moon is rotating. Okay, something is pushing it to rotate. Simple thing. Guys, have a fun. Attention.
And nothing is pushing it. Oh, it's getting an extremely gentle push from our tide, and therefore the moon is moving out 1.5 inches per year further away from us. So nobody is, other than that small amount of push by our tide.
So why is it rotating at that speed?
Do you want it to rotate faster or slower? And if so, why?
No. Why is it rotating? That's all. I don't say why it's slower or it's faster. Why it's rotating? Why it's rotating at a given speed?
Dick, it rotates on its axis. It revolves around the Earth.
Okay, which are you discussing? Are you talking about the rate at which it turns on its axis, or are you talking about the rate at which it proceeds around the Earth? Which?
The second one. Proceeds around the Earth.
Okay. If you could go out there and grab it and stop it from rotating, from making a circle around the Earth, if you could stop it from doing that, tell me what would happen.
It would fall down.
Okay. It has no choice. It's either got to be moving to stay out there, or it's going to fall down. It has no choice.
Who gave that rotation, that vector of the rotation to the moon and... based on the Newton's law, body put motion, stay in motion. What did motion come from?
You've already given me a hint. A Mars-sized planet, zillions of years ago, crashed into the Earth, disturbed a whole lot of material that became a disk around the Earth that eventually formed into the Moon, is our best guess. However, that impact was not a direct hit. It was a glancing blow. The glancing blow blasted off material with a circumferential velocity around the mass center of the Earth. That's where the original momentum came from. Over to you, Wes.
Okay. Is the moon slowing down?
Yes. In order to be in orbit around the Earth and gaining an inch and a half of extra altitude, larger radius per year, it is slowing down. It is slowing down in miles per hour. It is slowing down in the 28 days when the moon was a hell of a lot closer billions of years ago. The Earth probably didn't rotate in a 24-hour day. Maybe it rotated in a 12-hour day. And maybe the moon was twice as close as it is right now. And this orbital recession, because of the effect of the interaction of the tides on the moon, is slowly taking the kinetic rotational energy of the Earth, coupling it into the moon, and the moon is moving an inch and a half away from us further each year now. In an earlier time, it probably was moving even faster. Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
I'm going to ask you a stupid question, but you say it's allowed. You create a tube that is vacuumed around the Earth, and you put the body there, and you make the motion to that body. Would that body still be in motion?
That moon is moving through the world's best vacuum. There is no air resistance drag. It is two massive objects around each other. Earth and moon are a binary system. And by the way, while we're on that, let's assume that the N2XJN company invented a gravity sensing machine. And Wes, the chief scientist, at high noon, aimed the machine at the Earth, at the sun, and he measured the amount of solar gravity coming into his backyard in Queens. Then at midnight, when there was a full moon, he aimed the machine at the moon, and he measured the amount of lunar gravity coming into his backyard. So he's got two measurements. He's measured solar gravity, he's measured lunar gravity from his backyard in Queens. Which number is bigger? Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
Solar.
Press the mic, wait a second, and slowly give me an answer. Which gravity is bigger?
Solar.
Which one is creating the tides?
Solar.
Is the solar tide bigger than the lunar tide?
Sorry. No, not the solar. Lunar. I'm sorry. I used the wrong wording.
So you think the lunar tide is bigger? Okay. You think the lunar tide is bigger? Now give me a rough guess. Is it twice as big? 10 times as big? Is the lunar tide bigger than the solar tide? Is the lunar gravity bigger than the solar gravity?
Lunar gravity bigger than the solar. It depends from the point of reference. It's like you asking me at what speed am I moving, sitting in my house. The closest the mass. The closest the mass. It is. The bigger is the impact of its gravity on the Earth and to extreme.
My point of reference is your backyard in Queens. So I'm measuring, the XJN company is measuring the amount of solar gravity coming into Queens and measuring the amount of lunar gravity coming into Queens. And I think you're saying from, at that point of reference, the lunar gravity, I think you're saying, is greater. And give me a guess. Is it twice as big? 10 times as big? How much greater?
Mass of the... I should take the mass of the lunar and of the moon and divide it by mass of... Take the mass of the Earth, do the calculation, and then I would have the number. The same story would be... Also, the distance is important, so we try to calculate the same with the moon. We'll do exactly the same equation.
You're right on target. You now told me that you believe Newton's law of gravitational attraction. You have the ability to calculate it. And by the way, we're calculating the amount of force of gravity between sun and moon and between Sun and Earth, and between Moon and Earth. The Earth is constant in both cases, so we can cancel that one. So you take the amount of mass of Moon and divide it by square of the distance. You take the mass of the Sun divided by square of distance. You told me that you know how to calculate it, and you're absolutely right. You can do that calculation. You'll be surprised as all hell when you do it. Guess what you're going to discover?
The closest the body it is, the more impact it does have. We see the tides, but also we see a differentiation in the orbit of our closest moon, actually our moon, just because of the gravitation and the atmosphere.
Okay, now I'm going to give you some specifics. I'm going to round off the numbers to the nearest 10. The mass of the moon is 10 to the 24 kilograms. The mass of the sun is 10 to the 30 kilograms. 10 to the 24 versus 10 to the 30. 24 subtracted from 30 is 6. The sun is almost exactly 1 million times more massive than the moon. The sun is a million times more massive than the moon. Now you start looking at the distances. Sun is 93 million miles. Moon is 0.25 million miles. 0.24. 240,000 miles. And you square those numbers. And you do that division. When you do that, you'll find out that the solar gravity is more than 150 times greater than the moon's gravity to the Earth. Ain't that crazy? And now you're about to say, how the hell can the moon be making the tides? And there's a beautiful explanation for that. But let me run that one by you first. When you do that calculation, you and I can look up, there's websites that will give you right away, what is the mass of the moon? It's roughly 10 to the 24 kilograms. What's the mass of the sun? 10 to the 30 kilograms. We know the distance, so therefore we know how to do the squaring and the division, and you find out that the sun's gravity is 150 times greater. Let me look at it from one other point of view. Let me drop. The Earth is a pretty smart planet. It's going to go in orbit around something that gives it the greatest amount of gravity. What's the Earth in orbit around? It's in orbit around the sun. Is the Earth in orbit around the moon? No way. Hey, the moon and Earth are a binary system. The center of mass of those two is a point 1,000 miles below the equator of the Earth. They're both wobbling around that point. But what is the Earth really in orbit around? It's in orbit around the sun. The sun's gravity is 150 times greater. That, to me, is surprising as all hell. Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
Trying to quickly find something. The eccentric mass of each bulge exerts a small amount of gravitational attraction on the moon, with the bulge on the side of the Earth closest to the moon pulling in a direction slightly forward along the moon's orbit because of Earth's rotation has carried the bulge forward. The question is for you, what that particular pattern of Earth cruising around the sun comes from, and again, what was the initial energy that made it so?
Almost any heavenly body that comes into the proximity of another body is always going to be in circular motion one about the other. The rarest thing in the world, because the spaces between planets, the spaces between the suns, the spaces between everything, the spaces are so great, and the diameters of the objects by comparison to the space is so small, that when two things come together, a direct hit is almost impossible. They're never that accurate. It's always one is going to come toward the other, but because there's always, at the same time it's coming toward it, there's always some horizontal velocity that hasn't been corrected. Therefore, they're going to be in orbit around each other, the best they can do. Everything is in orbit around something else, 99.9% of the time.
I have a question of my own. I try to word it. because the time is finishing. You have a collider, but you build a collider some distance from the Earth's surface, and you put a vacuum there, and you speed the particles once. Those particles are going to stay in motion.
If a particle is in free space, where you've got the world's best vacuum, the universe's best vacuum.
No, I'm talking about artificial. You made an artificial tube around the Earth, and it's the biggest collider ever. Now, you speed up the particles initially. Are they going to stay in motion?
There's a kind of a yes and a no to that. How good is your vacuum in that tube is going to be creating some drag. How close are they moving to the speed of light? They're radiating energy when they're moving close to the speed of light. But in theory, I could put particles in a cyclotron, a particle accelerator, and they're going to move. If I don't add or subtract energy from them, they're going to continue moving in there for a long period of time. If I create a gyroscope in a vacuum with a perfect bearing, and I spin that gyroscope, it's going to spin for an awful long time because there is no drag to slow it down. Over to you, Wes, K2RAW.
Mid-equator is also the positioning of that tube that is important. It's here.
Okay, so you've built a... Large Hadron Collider. You've made a super large Hadron Collider, which is now a tube that's not 27 kilometers in circumference. It's going to be the circumference of the equator of the Earth. So, your company can finance a thing like that. So you've built this super collider, and now you're going to be able to move particles a hell of a lot faster, so to speak, than the Large Hadron Collider can do it. You're going to be able to do a much bigger experiment, Wes. What makes you think you couldn't do that, assuming you can afford it? Over to you, K2RAW, and I think you can afford it.
Good one. Thank you, Dick, for giving me so much time. Well, depends how you position that waveguide, another waveguide, that tube, whatever, the vacuum tube. Yeah. And you have a physical particles. They are not immune to gravity, and they are not immune to the magnetic field. Depends what particles. Okay. So now, my question is, I put the initial motion into them, and I'm not trying to collide them. I'm trying just to make them go around. Question is, are they going to stay in motion? Well, then, eventually, the particles from behind hit the particles that just launched.
If you've done a real good job of accelerating the particles, they're all moving at very close to the same speed. And when you start moving particles in, like, a Large Hadron Collider, the huge amount of force you have to overcome is centripetal force. In other words, you're moving them in a circular orbit. You're moving them very fast because of one of those crazy equations where, as you move them closer and closer to the speed of light, the apparent mass starts becoming a great big number. You're bending them into a circular path. These are charged particles. You're bending them into a circular path with super magnets, cryogenically cooled superconducting magnets. And the only thing that limits how fast you can move those particles, as far as energy is concerned, the number of giga electron volts of energy you give each of those particles, is limited by the maximum magnetic field you can create. And so you make your particle accelerator much bigger in diameter. You'll have less centrifugal force. You don't need as much magnetic field for the velocities we've used up till now. But you build that tube, and you make the tube smooth enough. There's no wiggles in it as it goes around that equator. And you build the magnets are strong enough, you're going to hit some brand new amount of energy. You're going to come close to the amount of energy of a gamma ray burst. You're going to really see what Mother Nature does with high energy physics. Over to you, Wes, K2RAW.
And we're going to be out of time. You can move at speed of light in space, but you can move infinitely fast through the time, right or wrong.
You can approach the speed of light with your point of reference. You never get there. You get closer and closer. The Large Hadron Collider gets up to the speed of light, 0.999, I think there's 18 nines in a row, is how close they get to the speed of light.
You can move infinitely fast through the time.
Okay. If you were riding on one of those particles, your watch would run at a particular rate. But you're outside of that tube watching those particles. Your watch continues running at the same rate as I see it, Wes. Go ahead.
I'll give you an example. If you go into the rocket ship and accelerate it, you could go what, for you, it looks like infinity fast. You could travel, say, 100 years, light years, to the 100 years, light year star, and get there by lunch. And then you turn around and get back to the Earth at the same day. So, my question to you is, with regard to the time reference, how old the people on the Earth would be? And we'll see it.
Yeah, this one's been covered in quite a few books. I'm the guy that's moving fast on the rocket ship, assuming I've got an infinite source of energy to do all this. And I think I've traveled for 1 year. And if I really get close enough to the speed of light, when I come back, all of my friends will already be dead. Because they've all died of old age. That differential time.
Hey, what was the time amount that passed? So the spaceship was traveling. Okay, I traveled to the star. That is 100 light years away. I get from there at end of the day. How much time passed on the Earth?
There's that Lorentz transformation that equates that. The bottom line is that I will come back a lot younger, apparently, according to the people on Earth, I will come back a lot younger than they are, and most of them probably have already died. So, with reference to Earth, I haven't aged. With reference to me, they have aged very fast, and I haven't. And so, you can never resolve those two. This was TechNet number 1582. I was going to tonight go through a little bit of Fourier transform because I was at a meeting today where somebody listened to the TechNet and said, gee, I'd like to hear a lot more about Fourier transform. We'll try to cover that next week. Space is also a fun thing, as you can tell. Of all the mail that John and I get, a good significant amount of it is with reference to the space report. Let me drop.
Let me just finish shortly that comment. Okay, it was 200 years in one day. So it means on the Earth, it was 200 years in one day. From their perspective, you're traveling very close to the speed of light, and it takes 200 years for light to get to the star and back. But for you, it was only one day. So you're aging slow down because you move forward through the time faster. It is actually Newton's law. We take into consideration a linear acceleration in space. However, it's not what is happening. You start out accelerating in space, but as you gain speed, you start accelerating through time instead. So you could only move at the speed of light in space, but you can move infinitely fast through the time. And to see it.
I think I almost agree with that, assuming you've got enough energy to do that. But where in the world did all that energy come from? As you get further away from the Earth, when you sense less gravity, you're going to age at a different rate. As you change your velocity, you're going to age at a different rate compared to an Earthbound observer. So, this relative jazz, the twin paradox. You can come back and your twin has already died of old age, and you're only a small amount older. And I guess Mr. Kelly on the International Space Station is being compared to his brother on the surface of the Earth on aging characteristics, among other things. They're really going to be looking at bone mass loss and muscle mass loss and things like that. I'm going to pass it over to John for any other comments. And over to you, John, and see you next week. And we're going to settle all these things next week. It says here, KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet. And Paul, thank you for all the stuff you've been doing. John, you got it.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick. Yep, good night. And I'd like to thank everybody who participated and listened and wrote in some of these nice questions. And we will try to do it again next week. By the way, Dick, I sent you an email. I don't know if you have a chance to read it. It was from Joe, RYY. Maybe you'd want to comment or pass some comments on that if you think so when you read it. That's all. Everybody enjoy and have some fun. Good night, Dick. Good night, Paul. Talk to you soon. KC2WGB.
By the way, Dick, did you get my email on the 8BSB?
Yes, I did. And you promised me it was going to be nice and simple. It is more understandable, but 8BSB, pretty complicated stuff. But you've been leading me to believe up till now that it maybe is going to change, that maybe we're going to, in the near future, get a new standard, a little bit closer to the European standard. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
The concept here is it becomes an international standard, meaning it can handle, well, actually, frame rates at this point don't really matter much anymore. Your TV set will play anything you can stick into it. But, yeah, and it's getting closer to changing really fast. K2RW, K2J.
I'm going to take you literally for a minute. If I picked up my current digital television set and I transported it over to Europe, and assuming that it would tune the frequencies of the carriers of Europe, I've got a little bit of a suspicion that currently my TV set would not be able to pick up European television. I think I need some brand new programming of that microprocessor inside my set. That's a guess. Over to you, Eric.
No, I was talking about video, but actually, there are more and more of the new sets. They play what's called Clear QAM, which is actually a form of DVB-T. And there are sets that you can, you don't realize it, but you can take them all over the place. And the channel standards are a little bit different, but the numbering and frequency organization is the same, so they move from place to place. And besides, the numbers don't mean anything anymore, do they?
I accept that. But the current European standard, to my knowledge, is not 8VSB. It's something a little bit different, quite different. So, unless somebody is willing to reprogram my set.
I'm trying to tell you something, but you're not listening.
Try again. I'm listening.
The sets that you buy now not only do 8VSB, but they also do something called QAM. Because you don't, may not realize it, but you can hook it up to a cable which uses QAM, which comes in many different varieties. And DVB-T, which they use in Europe, is one of them. As far as, like, channelization, it's pretty much the same all over the world in terms of blocks. The numbers don't necessarily match up, but the spaces do.
I'm having a little trouble believing that my particular model number of Vizio digital television will be able to give me a clear picture on that screen, an over-the-air broadcast of DVT standard in Europe. If I transport that to Europe, except for a frequency error of carrier, you're telling me I will see a picture on that screen?
I don't know if your particular model of video, but the more modern ones today, let's say you bought yours recently, so definitely does QAM. And there's a good possibility it'll do DVB-T, and you just don't know it.
If I go over to your house and steal the television set that's in your living room right now, and I bring it to Germany, in Heidelberg, and I connect it to an outside antenna, You're telling me I might see a picture?
My particular set, let's see, my particular set does ACSB-QAM. It does, yeah, it actually also has an input for DVBS, but...
Has anyone ever done that experiment? I mean, some of the modern digital television sets